This is Geek Speak, episode 36 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and a software conference producer. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Good. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Today, Miles will not be joining us. He'll be back, I'm sure, shortly. Today, unfortunately, Miles' father, John Wesley Elam III, passed away. Passed away this morning. It was expected, but of course, it's never expected in some ways. So we dedicate today's show to John Elam. Thank you for being such an amazing man. All right.
And thank you for giving us Miles.
Definitely. All right. Let's talk about the World Wide Web.
Yeah, going back in time, 25 years. We had an anniversary a couple weeks ago that we didn't mention, which was the first time the World Wide Web was actually up and running. And then just last week, just after, just before the show was put up on the feed last week, we got the real anniversary, which is the first time the public got to use the web. Uh-huh. So there's been a lot of articles about this. There's been a lot of talk over the years about it. But of course, Tim Berners-Lee, using a Next machine, got this fancy idea of a way to use computers to easily share a lot of the information at CERN, and this quickly spread. One of the things I was really fascinated by reading was that not only was there a HTTP server that he made, but the very first way to read the web was actually through FTP servers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You could download the HTML files through an FTP server. It was one of the suggested ways. But, of course, the HTTP server took over.
Of course, in that regard, you wouldn't have to do the some kind of client that would read HTTP. Directly, instead you could do FTP. And so people were used to FTP clients being a way of getting data off the net because that protocol is old.
Yeah, and what, there was also Gopher at the time and stuff like this. This was August 23rd, 1991. Wow. Were you on the internet before 91?
Let's see, I was online for the first time. No, I think I first saw the web, if you will. Well, I was on BBSs, right, on bulletin board systems at that time, definitely. And, you know, downloading font files and stuff from people and conversing in that way. But the first time I actually saw the web was in 94, 95, somewhere in there.
Yeah, which
someone,
of course,
showed me, like, I can't remember what website it was, but showed me kind of how to start looking at source code and the whole deal. And then that's where my fascination went.
Yeah. And of course, I think 95 is really the year that people started to hear about what this thing, the web, was.
Yeah, I agree.
The Netscape browser was coming out. I remember in 89, I had a teacher. She said, "This is really cool, Brian. You got to see this. You can talk to people in Russia through this thing called the internet." And so that was back then, of course, all command line work. And I didn't even know about the web for another few years.
I'm trying to see when I actually first registered my domain name, because I had my last name as domain name. And that would have been very quickly after I understood what the web was.
Really? You were doing that right away? Because I didn't even do that till 99.
1997, June of 1997 is when I got my domain name. So it's pretty early.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on, shall we? Speaking of the web, actually, and websites, when we took over GeekSpeak in 2000, when Miles and I started GeekSpeak in 2000 from the people that had founded it, they gave us the domain name, and I quickly put up updated the page, and over the years, I've done a lot of work on the GeekSpeak.org site, including, of course, in 2004. Five starting RSS feeds. I think our first show was December of 2004. It was the first one. It wasn't a podcast, but that was actually put up in the beginning of 2005. It makes us very early in the podcasting scene, actually. Earlier, an older podcast than actually the Twit Networks podcast, which I found is fascinating because I think of them as what we do. They've been doing forever. So, we've actually been doing it longer.
So why are we not sitting in a multi-million-dollar studio?
Because they're better at what they do. Like, we've also always volunteered, so it's a different type of form. Any case,
yeah, we're working and we're not journalists.
That's right.
Every one of the geeks is somebody that in some way is making a living out of tech.
Yeah, definitely. So over the years, I've done different versions, and the current version, geekspeak.org, is a Ruby on Rails app running on an instance at DigitalOcean, running with an Nginx front end. And the entire source of it is online at my GitHub account, which is github.org github.com/lyle/geekspeak.org. So you can see all the source code. And recently someone, and now of course I've lost the information about who it was, so I will read it from our website. Hey geeks, I noticed a couple of typos on your support pages from Aaron, our listener Aaron. Trivial but worth fixing, I think, and just listed out some things. So I said, hey Aaron, thanks. Do you know how to use Git? And I linked him over to the site when you want to do a pull request. And sure enough, he created an account, maybe he already had an account, made all the changes necessary and did a pull request. I reviewed it really quick, accepted it, did a pull, did a push, did a Capistrano deploy, and our website was updated. Thank you so much, Aaron. That was a while ago. And I just want to mention how cool it is to have like a, an open source kind of feel for the content that we produce.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, we don't have the time to do everything that we want to do with this show. So more people get involved, better.
And I do update GeekSpeak's site, especially more often since we've had patrons, pretty regularly. Every month I've got to put up, you know, the thank yous for people that have contributed. In general, I like to improve, and I've been more motivated since we left the station to do so. But not that I wasn't updating it, but the capability isn't there. My spelling is atrocious. So it was extremely helpful. So anyway, thanks so much to Aaron for helping us. And if you're kind of curious about source code of what we do, please take a look. It is a very old app that's crusty. I'm not real proud of the code, but you know, you never are.
Hey, it's better than FTP serving of HTML.
It's true. And it is easy for us to edit the site. All right. Seymour?
Okay.
Parpet? Who's this?
Okay, so I'm actually not too familiar with Seymour Parpet. Unfortunately, this is coming to me because he passed away just recently. But in reading about him, I've gotten really fascinated because when I was back in middle school, the programming language at the time was Logo, the graphic sort of programming language to move the turtle around the screen to be able to draw. And what I didn't realize is that this gentleman named Papert invented that as a way to teach children how to learn. It wasn't specifically teaching them programming, but actually teaching them how to learn.
Right.
And I got really interested, and I want to look into this. He wrote a book called Mindstorms, Children, Computers, and Powerful Ideas. And I was wondering, have you read this book? Have you heard about this?
I haven't read that book.
Yeah. So, you know, nowadays we're talking about how easy it is to learn how to program and how many people are suggesting and saying that we need to have more computer science classes in high school and people can just easily learn to pick up all these new languages that are coming out. But of course, this idea has been around for ages. And I am sad to hear that one of the founders of the idea of teaching kids to learn through their own self-guided learning through programming has passed. But I want to look into it more.
The Logo programming language was actually 1997, and four different people are attributed to creating it.
Not 97. That's
1967. Sorry.
Thank you.
1967. Four different people are attributed. And yeah, our mutual friend Warren Sack, Professor Sack at UCSC, uses Logo and has used Logo quite a bit to teach people conceptual programming concepts, right? Because it's a really neat way to quickly produce drawings and things using functions and general light code. And I think he actually has a whole library of Logo commands interpretation using JavaScript and then rendering to the browser. So you can type Logo, but you're actually running JavaScript and you know, making the turtle draw around. This is you know, pen down, move forward, pen up, you
right?
Know, that kind of
the most simplistic kind of idea of drawing, but yeah, you know, this idea of learning to program is teaching you how to think has been around. That was one of the famous quotes from Steve Jobs, that everyone should learn to code so you can learn how to think. But
I didn't know that was one of Steve Jobs's.
Yeah, it's one of the many pithy things he's talked about.
I don't
about.
Think of him as a coder at all.
No. Well, he was involved in Breakout.
Yeah. okay. Well, thank you so much for that. And sorry to hear that Parpet passed away.
Well, speaking of learning to code, learning things in the classroom, I've got another story here that is about some research that's been going on about technology in the classroom and computers in the classroom. And I was reading through this article trying to make sense of it. The studies that it's referring to, and this is an article that is coming out of NPR Ed, it's referring to several studies about how classrooms that are using technology and using computers, that the students are getting poorer grades out of classrooms that use the computer more. And it's,
oh, no. It's not a good sign.
It's not a good sign. And it's funny because I mean, I've got some small kids, 8 and almost 11-year-old, and I actually kept them away from the computer for quite a while.
And your 11-year-old just started 5th grade, and that this is the first time that school has required a Chromebook or a laptop for part of the teaching.
Pretty much a Chromebook.
The study is completely applicable to what's going on for you, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And I kept my kids away from it because I had this feeling like, I remember when I wanted to play with a computer. I didn't need any teacher to show me how to do it. It was something that I just was excited to do, and my entire experience as everybody around me was like that as well. But learning how to learn is a different process than actually using a computer.
Well,
so
I, as a parent, have struggled over the years on how much media consumption the kids should be involved with, and one of the things that I've always felt the core foundation for me is I want the kids to be broad in their understanding of the world, right?
Yeah.
I want them to be able to use their hands and play with clay, and I don't want them to isolate themselves too quickly into one narrow focus. And the computer is such an expansive engagement in the world, it's very easy to make that your only focus. So it's really about balance for me. It's always been about balance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And getting back to these studies, a couple of things that came out of it, and the reason why I say I was trying to make sense of it is because these are very, very large studies, including the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development doing an international study, and including thousands of schools, students, and classrooms. And when I looked through the different kinds of studies that they're referring to, they're very large studies, very general studies, but they're actually getting information from the classroom. And when I look through it, I don't see any of the kind of modes of learning that I've been really excited about. This whole idea, like with the Khan Academy, where you go through their learning programs, there are different exercises, and you don't get to move on until you've shown a certain amount of mastery.
Sure.
You'll just keep redoing the tests and tests over and over again until you actually get to a point where you can say, okay, must know this to have gotten answered that many right.
What are the kind of examples of the study, these kind of studies? Is there like whether the kids had computers in the classroom versus not, and it's just as basic as that? Or is there more to what they're investigating?
Right. It is as basic as that. Are they doing instruction? Are they doing exercises on the computer?
I guess it's kind of a summary of multiple studies. Is that kind of the...
Yeah. There's three large studies that this is pulling its conclusions out of. And one of those is in North Carolina, where there was an Algebra 1 class that they did... a test where some of the classes were doing using the computer instruction. It was assisted learning where they would do exercises through the computer, and other classes were not.
But the same Algebra 1.
But
so
the same,
Algebra 1, break them up.
Same Algebra 1.
Interesting.
Well, the ones that they tested that had been using the computer got a worse grade. In fact, a much worse grade than the other ones. And the interesting thing about that, and the thing they pointed to as a hole in the study is, yes, they know the students were using this program, not in the sense of a computer program, but this learning program. But they can't be sure how much of the time they were using it.
Mm.
And so they're in this place where they're saying, yeah, that people are getting really bad grades, but they don't know how well implemented this curriculum is using the computer.
Right. Also, was it a different teacher? Was one teacher doing, you know, traditional teaching, and the other teacher was doing computer-aided teaching? And they're two different teachers, and therefore completely different. Like, it's very hard to get down to the crux of it. Also, it's one school. Who knows, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so this article piqued my interest. I wish I could say that it had conclusions in there, but I do kind of agree that we should be very light on our use of computers in the classroom, except for using it as the tool it's meant to be used, as reports and research and when people get to the point where they are using the computer as a way to construct something. Programming or doing a creative project, that's great, as long as we're not relying on the computer to do any sort of the teaching.
Right. What do you think? Do you find that like the loss of penmanship is going to be a problem? I mean, are you concerned about that kind of thing? I mean, that's always brought up by people, but come on, does it really matter that much?
No. I don't care about that. What's funny about that is now that I got my iPad Pro with this pen, I'm actually taking notes in handwritten again.
Are you?
I am, and you know what's funny about that? Because my notes are actually more illustrative than just writing text. I've tried to use a text note taker for ages,
yeah.
and I still do it a lot of times in meetings and stuff. But I find using a pencil, it's using a different part of my brain that kind of is a little bit automatic. And mm-hmm. I look back at the drawings I was doing during the meeting and realizing I'm actually pulling out memories and information just yes. from having those.
Yeah. When I doodle, I definitely have better better memory of the experience that I was engaging with. I'm a visual learner, definitely. All right. Well, thank you for that story on – and I'll have to read up on that study. I think it's – I mean, maybe I actually won't read up on the study, but I think it's interesting to see that there's a pushback to some degree because we see a lot of flow of computers in the classroom. That's just like the standard. Last year or a couple years ago when my son started middle school, that was the first year they used laptops. Now your daughter, who's a few years younger, the first year that the elementary is now using laptops. And of course, there's this side effect also that they happen to all be Google accounts. So all the kids are getting Google accounts and are getting comfortable with the Google Docs and sharing. And all the administrative and teachers have access to all the data that they've got through Google Docs, which is fine. It's kind of like old classrooms. But it is a little hair-raising, you know, a little.
Well, and of course, there are some laws to regulate the what information can be captured and, yeah. and analyzed.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the things they point to in the study that because of privacy restrictions, they're having a hard time getting the data they would want to study.
Sure. Yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, when my son required to get a laptop in middle school 3 years ago, I talked to the IT person for the campus, and I'd suggested some concerns I had, and he said, would you be willing to sit on a committee to kind of oversee, if you will? And I said, yes, but I haven't done that. You and I should do that. Let's move on. Do you guys do you use WhatsApp?
You know, I still haven't opened that one up.
Yeah, I've used it. You know, there's WhatsApp and WeChat and Snapchat, and all of these kind of have the same value to me. A couple people that I know use each of them, and I've opened and installed and created accounts for each of them. But for some users, that is the de facto messaging system. WhatsApp has a billion users, and WhatsApp's a chat application. And we won't go into the details of the differences and all that. It doesn't matter. There's about a billion people using it. And it was bought by Facebook a while ago. And WhatsApp actually had a monthly fee capability or a yearly fee capability, which they disabled recently. And what's happening now is they just made an announcement. In fact, on the 25th of this month, they were announcing to users that they will be sharing the mobile phone number. You to use WhatsApp, you use your phone number. And you basically log your phone number, then you got a text message, and you put that code in. And then WhatsApp was using your phone number as your login capability. So it's extremely easy to use as a phone chatting system. And of course, free if you have a network, and therefore better than text messaging. But also had extra features like picture sharing and things like that and groups. So in any case, they've just announced that they will be sharing the mobile number for the WhatsApp account with Facebook. Now, of course, it's the same company. But the general idea behind this will be that Facebook will be able to use the mobile app to connect which account is on WeChat and WhatsApp. And thereby, it's confusing. And thereby allowing them to market to those users on Facebook, specifically allow advertisers to advertise to the users on Facebook only based off of the mobile number they have on WhatsApp.
Okay, so wait a second. WhatsApp is totally encrypted. This was another story yes. a few months ago where they switched over to a encryption scheme where even WhatsApp can't tell what your messages are.
That's right.
So the only information that Facebook is getting is that there is an account on WhatsApp and it has this phone number and they're somehow correlating that to a Facebook user. So where is the advertising coming here?
The advertising shows up on Facebook.
But what information...
What benefit does it have?
What information do they get from WhatsApp?
It's the advertising of that, but it's also the ability to potentially, and this is one of the things that's mentioned in their updated privacy policy, is that messages you may receive containing marketing could include an offer for something that might interest you. The idea being here that a company that's advertising on Facebook that has an address book of – okay, let me specify this. Facebook wants to keep the privacy to some degree, but they also have advertisers that want to advertise to certain users. So Facebook has a very robust ability to have an advertiser say, I want to advertise to these people. And they can say things like, I want people that live in Los Gatos, California, or I want people that speak this language, or I want people that are interested in these types of things. So Facebook takes that and delivers those ads to those users, very much specific to what the advertiser wants. But the advertiser doesn't know who that targeted user is. Okay?
Okay.
The next thing the advertiser can do is the advertiser can upload phone numbers and say, these are all my users. And when uploading all those users, they say, I want these messages to show up to these users. And then Facebook doesn't tell the advertiser what user gets it, but they will then target that population. And so having more phone numbers association is good.
And of course, not everybody puts their phone number or their newest phone number or their active phone number into Facebook. There's no requirement for that at all.
That's right. Additionally, you could see an advertiser say, I want to send a message to this user. And so you know how when you get let's say you're late for a bill or something and you can get a text message, or your credit card will say, hey, there might be a wrong charge on your account. That feature of getting a text message alert in most jurisdictions and such is regulated by governmental rule, right, by rules of conduct on phone system. So that's why you always have checkboxes of I want text messages or not. And that's all based, of course, on text messaging is costing money. So you don't want somebody to send you a whole bunch of text messages unless you kind of opt in. So we've had this large dialogue around how text messages work. Messaging on WhatsApp does not work like that. There aren't any regulations around it. So an advertiser or a company that has customers of a certain numbers could theoretically send a message to that user through WhatsApp if Facebook allowed it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So there's a growth area here, and Facebook's kind of opening that capability up. And of course, a lot of WhatsApp users are upset. It is nice to know that it's still end-to-end encryption. That's really kind of cool.
Right. So whatever you communicate about at all is going to be completely private.
Yes. Unlike Facebook Messenger. Facebook Messenger theoretically can do that, but in a lot of in Facebook in general, they can also scrape the dialogue that's being spoken about for content that is useful for advertisers. So let's say you post on my website something about routers, and then in my feed, as I read that and like that article, or you just posted and I liked your article, then in my side advertising location on Facebook, I might start seeing ads for different types of routers. Not because I went to a site and searched for routers, but because we talked about them. And so therefore, we're users that are engaged in talking about routers. And that's how Facebook's making their money, right? They're making a lot of money. Recently, I ran an ad. You know, I've been talking about people giving us money on Patreon to help spread the word of the show. And me not being an expert on marketing and not having a lot of funds, I went ahead and did a Facebook ad to see what it would be like to advertise for the Geekspeak podcast on Facebook. And I targeted Canada, India, UK, and Oregon.
And Oregon.
Well, so the rates for – and I basically targeted people who were interested in technology and, you know, things that kind of represent the show, English speakers. And I picked one part of the country because depending on what your criteria is for your ad when you do it on Facebook, they're going to give you different kinds of rates. So if you target a population that is an expensive population, then you're competing with other people that are targeting that same population. And I personally just am interested in anybody that might be interested in our show coming on board. We're not selling anything, right? So we just want to, you know, increase the people that might enjoy the show.
Yeah, so reach the people that might want to hear us.
Right. To me, it doesn't matter that much who comes aboard and listens and enjoys. It's not like I'm trying to get people that are going to buy a certain thing. I'm much more broad than that, right? So therefore, it didn't matter to me where we picked, and I figured if I picked one location or a couple locations in the U.S., it'd be better than a broad one. And I tried all of U.S., and the price went up, right? So right now we're just investigating and playing with it. But it was very edifying to see what the criteria that I could search for was.
So what was the most detailed item that you saw on there? Was it
area
of interest?
Or? It was interesting to see that there was area of interest podcasting technology. Like that was like, oh, well, that's kind of cool. Because, of course, if you don't really know what a podcast is, it's really hard to subscribe to a podcast, right? You have to kind of already be engaged. Yeah. So that was very useful. There wasn't a lot other things. I could definitely have gone down like ages and gender and all these things, but that's exactly what I don't want to do, right?
Right.
I don't know. I should probably take the stats of what the ad was like and how many people came by and put that on GeekSpeak and show people. I'll make sure that's okay to the rules of Facebook. And it was expensive. I mean, not expensive. I think we spent $35, something like that, running this for a week. And something like 20,000 people saw our little video ad, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it was cool. It wasn't anything that was specifically targeted to be an ad, but it was just some of our content.
And we had a lot more visitors to our homepage and realized after that we definitely need to have a player on our homepage so people can start listening to the show right away without podcasting subscription.
So where do you come down on on privacy and advertising. Do you like the idea of getting ads targeted to you that might be interesting to you, or do you rather be completely anonymous and get whatever it is that comes up into the random pop feed?
I use Amazon and I use Facebook, and I use it on the same machine with the same cookies. And so constantly, whatever I've searched recently on Amazon shows up all throughout the website, you know, all throughout other websites on my side. I never use those ads to purchase. But I'm sure that seeing the same ad over and over kind of affects my human judgment. So I'm definitely being affected by it. But I'm not in a situation where I log out and do that. I find it much more interesting to be aware of it and kind of pay attention so I can talk about it intelligently. I don't have any tracking on the GeekSpeak site. I figure if you go to GeekSpeak, our website, I don't want to have like you automatically logging that you went there onto Google Analytics or Facebook. So I've turned that stuff off. I had it on for a while. And so I'm much more about like giving people the freedom to do what they want to do. And myself, I just embrace all of it. What about you?
Oh, I go back and forth. I like the idea of actually getting information that's at all useful to me, even though I've become, I don't know, an expert at ignoring all of the ads. But when it comes down to it, I think the biggest security or privacy problems these days is the fact that somebody might have a warehouse of information, not for what they would do with it, but for what happens when it gets in the hands that you don't want it in. So that's the only place I worry.
That is interesting. Meaning that it's one of the concerns I had about the kids being on all their data being one location.
Yeah, we have a pretty high level of trust for Google as a company. It's in their interest to keep our children's information secure, but still hacks happen. Information gets leaked out.
And additionally, security is very complicated and access is very complicated. I mean, here's a great example of the Google Doc environment at the school district that our kids go to. There, they have basically two roles. They have a student role and they have a staff role. And the staff role can see all the data of the student. And all of the employees at the school district have staff accounts. So theoretically, a teacher that's not even associated with your kid, you know, from a different school, can go and look at your kid's stuff. Now, that's kind of possible before because maybe they had a meeting in the main office and they could see things. But the simplicity of doing that is what's concerning, right? It's not that the staff's not trusted and all that. It's just that now it's really easy for someone to peruse. It also used to be a situation where your student would write something and it would go to the teacher and the teacher would grade it and the grade would go in a grade book and that would be kept forever in a paper form, probably for a long time, maybe digital. But the paper itself would go back to the student. Now the paper is there on the system for a while. And it's not that I don't trust, you know, the janitorial staff at the school and whether does it really matter if the kid's writing something, really? But it's just the change of that scope and not thinking about it and paying attention to it that concerns me. Like, we should be aware of it and thinking about the ramifications. And it's interesting because, of course, the IT person, as I was talking to them about this, said, well, we should have a set of rules and regulations and process. And I'm coming from working at Netflix where we don't have process and rules. We have a lot of freedom and responsibility. And the reason for that is as you produce rules and procedures, you make bureaucracy, which makes people not be as effective. Like, that's the rule. Like, that's how it works.
Is it about bureaucracy or is it about stopping thinking of your actions? Because, I mean, when you rely on the system, you forget what your actions may be doing.
I think they connect really closely. I think if you are given a whole bunch of rules and you're not given a reasoning for those rules, then anything that's not covered by a rule feels like it's okay to do. If instead you're given a lot of understanding and context of what's going on, then you have to always decide what the rule is for yourself. And therefore, your ability to be human comes into play and you start acting ethically. I had this amazing experience when I was traveling to France. And I was in an office with a whole bunch of JavaScript developers in out of Paris in Clichy, and there was a coffee machine, a little what are those little coffee machines that use the pellets?
Nespresso.
Nespresso.
Yes.
Clooney does those ads for them. Oh man, I hate those things. I don't think it's very good coffee, but in any case, a lot of people use it. Maybe I'm wrong, and I don't know what I'm talking about.
But Europeans know their coffee.
So I'm in this office, and I'm sitting down at a shared desk, and I've got my laptop, and I don't speak any French, and everybody's speaking around me. But of course, a lot of the programming we're doing, I understand because it's JavaScript, and they have to kind of understand JavaScript, which is basically English in a lot of ways. So we're going along fine, and a colleague says, "Here, you want Nespresso?" And she gives me one of her pellets to use in the shared Nespresso machine. And I'm like, oh, thanks. And I made some coffee. And then I noticed that everybody had their – I drank for a while, like a couple of cups. And then I realized I was actually drinking her personal stash, not the office stash of coffee. And I'm thinking, this is weird. Like, it seems kind of wasteful. So I go to the manager. I'm like, hey, why don't you just buy the Nespresso tablets for everybody? It's going to cost you maybe $100 a week. And everybody just doesn't have to think about it and worry about their own collection and passing back and forth and this weird idea of maybe theft happening. Like, just – pay for it. It costs nothing. He's like, no, I can't do that here. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, here, everybody goes by a rule. It's a very – the socialized community is such that everybody goes by a general – whatever rule is put in forth, they take advantage of that rule completely. So everything's extremely structured. You cannot take a break. You have to have a break. Like, it's extremely structured. If I say this coffee is for you, they'll take it home. I said, no, that's silly. They won't take it home. He's like, yeah, they will take it home. And
this is the unwritten social rule in Paris, in France?
Well, at least in this office, from this manager's opinion. I mean, I can't say that this is universal to all French employees by any means, but it definitely made sense to what he was saying. And I'll try to clarify a little bit more. He was basically saying that because everything is regulated perfectly, like everything is like really clear, you get this much vacation a year, you get this much, you know, if you get fired, this is how much severance you get for this period of time. Everything is very written down. There's no like general, there's no freedom in that regard. It's very structured so that everyone's taken care of. Because of that, when you get a rule like you have to take lunch for half an hour every day at this time, if you don't take advantage of that, then you're losing out. Like you're not getting the same benefit everybody else is. If you don't take your vacation, that's you're giving up something. So if you're given coffee and you don't take as much as you can take, then you're giving something away. So it behooves you to operate in such a way that you take care of yourself as much as possible. And the free coffee would mean take it home. And there'd be nothing wrong with taking it home. It'd be completely appropriate.
Because that's the rule.
Blew my mind. Yeah. Well, exactly. Anyway.
So that we got on all of that just because of procedures.
Procedures. So
and people stop thinking.
Right. I'd rather have people thinking. But of course, in technology, it's very hard to think about these complex concepts.
Well, behind a computer screen, it becomes anonymous, at least to some degree, and you forget the ramifications. But I don't know. We're getting to the age now where we have digital natives, people that from the earliest moment of life have had a screen around them. So maybe our society is going to adapt by now?
Maybe. Hey, let's talk about airline industry.
Okay, so the last time we had a show, that was just you and me. Mm-hmm. We just happened to be in the same city at the same time.
Oh, in Vegas.
In Vegas, yeah. So you got home. I think you left a day before I did. Mm-hmm. But I left on a – no, you left a couple days before me because I left on a Friday afternoon. Well, at least that's when I left the conference. I didn't get home for 24 hours because Southwest was having their computer failure, which had happened 2 days earlier on a Wednesday. So this computer failure, which I think had the computers down for about 12 hours, the entire system got backed up so much so that by the time I showed up to the airport 2 days later, they were still canceling flights left and right. I had three flights canceled on me, and I finally took one to a different city, not to home, just so I could get closer. Well,
do you know that the day I left was actually Wednesday, the day that the system failed?
Did you get on the plane without a problem?
No. So what I did was we found out that Southwest was having a problem because a couple of employees were trying to confirm their flights and couldn't confirm because Southwest.com was down, like the entire system. And so we were like, well, what should we do? Well, let's go ahead and get out different airlines. So we all just independently purchased flights on, I think, Delta or some other airline and flew, not with requesting this from anybody or talking to anybody at at Netflix, just because we're given freedom and responsibility. So we just acted. We're like, well, it makes more sense for us to get home. We can work tomorrow from the office. Let's just do this. So we went ahead and all purchased it. And it was, I don't know how much it was, but it was, a flight from Vegas out.
Last minute flight.
Yeah, 4 hours later, something like that. And then later we got reimbursed for the Southwest flight. So it was not a problem at all. But it was so much more effective than spending all this time trying to deal with it that you might do at some companies. So in any case, freedom and responsibility. I can't say more better things about it. But go on. So what'd you do?
What did I do? I had to haggle, get a room for the night, and take an Uber over to a hotel that was 15 miles out of town. Mm-hmm. And then get up early in the morning to go find out that my flight was canceled some more. But
so you were in Vegas the whole time. Where do you actually? What city do you actually fly to?
I went to San Diego. I went to Orange County just to get back up to San Jose, and I think I got here sooner than I would have otherwise.
All right. What's besides the complaint? What's the news story?
Well, okay. So Delta had a very similar problem. Their whole system went down, and they had 1,000 flights canceled because their system went down. So people are asking, what's up with all of these airline systems?
Is this a hack of some sort? Is somebody attacking them?
No, in this case, it wasn't. It was, I know in the Southwest case, it was hardware failure and, they had a loss of power. I got a number of, posts on Hacker News talking about this, and people are asking, why are the airlines using a system that's so fragile? It's obviously fragile. They're not able to keep their uptime. Why aren't they using AWS or Azure, one of the big cloud providers for their computer system, so they can get that 99.99999 uptime?
Right. What you're talking about is an infrastructure that's designed that you have like a centralized hardware, maybe a database is centralized, and everybody's mirroring off of that. That database fails, and you have like 12 hours before you get back online. That's unacceptable nowadays, right?
Exactly.
You can now have infrastructure such that you can take down a whole continent and still be online.
Exactly. This person from Delta was trying to explain that because of all of the different security concerns and privacy concerns about who's on what flight and how to manage these concerns, it was their decision that they need to have their systems centrally located in one place. And they have backup systems, and the backup systems simply didn't come up quickly enough to be able to get around this 1,000 flight cancellation. People are saying, but hospitals out there, they use cloud providers because and they have to deal with HIPAA regulations.
Sure.
and so many other privacy concerns. I don't have a resolution to this on why this is necessary for them, but the airline industry just seems to believe that a central point of failure is still better than spreading their data across servers that they don't control.
Well, they just aren't up to date. I wonder if Virgin feels that way. I mean, there must be some airlines that are a little
newer. The newest ones.
Yeah, that understand the importance of first off, having virtualized layer has a lot of benefits. But in case, by the way, HIPAA stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. That was passed by Congress in 1996. And this, of course, is what if you're going to hold any kind of medical records, what you have to apply to, like what you have to abide by in the United States.
But of course, if a terrorist organization or anybody else wanted to attack the U.S. and make a huge disruption, if they can find any of these major airlines' central points of failure and be able to cut the line,
it's pretty problematic.
Yeah, no, it grounded an entire airline for days.
You know, it's interesting. At one point, there was capability of an individual to an airline to have a list of names and check them off and have them people get on air, right, on the flight. But no longer can you actually do the backup paper, right? That doesn't exist. It's not possible. It's probably not even legal, right? I mean, it's this interesting dynamic that once you get to a certain level of technical level in your society, you cannot fall back to without that.
Because you lose the knowledge of how to make it work.
Right. I mean, even like your clerk at a grocery store right now, could they actually check you out of the grocery store without the computer? No. There's no prices.
Yeah,
right?
I've been to stores where the power's out and they just say, sorry, we can't sell anything to you.
Which is crazy. Ridiculously crazy. And of course, places where they lose power a lot, they can do that. Like they in a situation where they're not relying on the tech because it's too flaky, they're fine when it goes out.
But of course, we get a huge benefit from this. We get a really efficient system. We get cheaper prices.
Absolutely. When I did want to book my flight that day because I heard that Southwest was down, I went online and within like a half an hour had a flight. Like it was done. I didn't talk to anybody on the phone. And then when I wanted to get reimbursed for the Southwest thing, like a week later, I sent a note, an email. I got an email back and that was it. Like it was extremely easy compared to a giant phone tree or having to go to the airport? I mean, I'm assuming at some point, like, part of your process was calling someone at the airport, right? It's not like that anymore.
I avoided that. Talk to somebody on a phone? No. Why would I do that?
Why would you ever do that? Hey, we both had the same story, and I think we might as well cover it now. And that is that taxis, there's been a Singapore taxi that's totally changed the way things work.
Well, they're going into – it's not even a – I guess you can call it a beta test. They are determined to, in the next 2 years, actually a year and a half, roll out a fleet of 1,000 autonomous taxis. But right now they're starting up in just Singapore's business district called One North, and they are the official Singapore government's partner, and the company name is called Nutonomy.
Nutonomy. It's a great name for that. And their project is actually right now, if you're in this district of Singapore, you can hail a cab and get driven, and that cab will theoretically drive by itself. Now, there's actually...
Yeah, this is not Johnny Cab. There's right. Not a plastic driver behind the wheel.
There's actually a real driver. Right now, for the beta program, there's actually a human being making sure that everything goes well and can take over the wheel at any point. But they're just piloting it out, and this is a 2.5 square mile business area called One North. So if you're familiar with Singapore and you know that area, I would love to hear that someone's visited and done this. I think it's kind of cool. Of course, even here, I know a lot of people that – well, I know someone that actually works on the Google self-driving car, right? So I know a lot of people that have been in these vehicles. I haven't actually driven in one. But would you do it? Would you go ahead and take it at this point?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Would you let your kids go to school in an autonomous vehicle?
I can't wait for that day that I can trust it. I guess right now I'm still worried about the driver.
The other thing that Doug Parker of Nutonomy's chief operating officer claims that with autonomous cabs in this area, they could remove like 900,000 to 300,000 vehicles from the roadways, with the idea that the vehicles can always be driving and always moving people around, and therefore you need less vehicles. I hear that a lot, but at the same time, I'm always thinking, is it ever really going to be realized at that level? Or are we still going to have this idea of ownership more, or this idea that how shared will we be with vehicles? Taxis are a perfect example of, well, of course, they'll be driving all the time. Makes total sense. But will we have these vehicles that we share, or will we only switch over to taxis, just not own a vehicle anymore?
Okay. I personally think that it's absolutely going to go a huge shift over the next 10 years to the point where we don't have personal ownership of vehicles, and that it'll just be so much cheaper and efficient for these autonomous cars to be driving us around. The cars themselves may be expensive, but they're going to make sense as far as money goes, because they're going to be used so efficiently. But it's funny. I got into this whole discussion with a coworker because, you know, Tesla has announced their plans to do an autonomous vehicle.
Sure.
In fact, they want to be able to sell a Tesla to somebody who can then put it into, I forgot what mode they call it, but basically go make money for me mode.
Right.
Go do the bidding of whatever the network says, and somebody else can take this car around and be picked up and dropped off by them. But my coworker is saying, how are people ever going to do this? Because I would never let my expensive Tesla go out and make money for me, because I don't know what person's going to get in the car and what they're going to do and what they're going to spill. And
but that's the thing, is that the system will not be like random person gets in. It will be a user that's accountable and knows. And like afterwards, you'll know how much damage they did. Like it's not going to be a willy-nilly like throw your keys out into the street, right? It's going to be much more structured than that.
Right, but let me ask everyone, you this. Everyone will have a reputation and right. You can't get a car without that.
Absolutely. Brian, you and I both live in places where if there was no vehicle there, we're not really going anywhere. I'm a little more mobile than you, but I mean, I can walk a mile to get to a store.
Hey, I have a bus stop closer to me than you do.
There you go. But you're still waiting for traffic from somebody else, right? You're still waiting for somebody else to drive you around. On a Saturday, it's 2 o'clock, a pipe bursts, you have no vehicle. How do you fix that? Like, you know what I mean? Like there's situations where having the ability to move immediately because you want to has a value to it that is harder than saying, I need a vehicle here now.
Yeah, but I'm imagining a system where you've got an incredibly complex computer system trying to predict where people are going to need a vehicle. So they're not only just sending vehicles from one caller to another caller, and they're not just routing to drop somebody off and pick somebody up, but they're doing multiple people along that route. And you reach, just like with social networks, you reach a sort of a tipping point where it becomes incredibly efficient. So yeah, we live what's pretty much out in the country, even though we're so close to Silicon Valley. But I can imagine the system saying, okay, on average, at this time of day, we need this many cars out there roaming, and we're not going to make as much money off of those, but we're going to make a lot of money just because people are starting to rely on this everywhere.
And the other aspect of this is that the system we currently have in place is completely wasteful in every single way, right? You have three vehicles at your house because you've got a pickup truck and other vehicles, and lots of times they're not being used at all, right? So in your community, there's, 80 cars being wasted all the time, like constantly wasted all the time. And that, of course, is a pretty horrible system. So getting away from that does make some sense. I'm just curious how far it'll go.
Yeah. And I drive to the city and I'm just looking at all the parking lots and all the stacked parking, just imagining what we can do with that space if we don't need to park cars there anymore.
Okay, so speaking of neighborhoods and such,
you're jumping around. I'm totally lost.
Next one on the list, man. Next Door. I've never used Next Door, but you have used Next Door, right? Or do you use Facebook groups?
No. I use both.
Okay.
They're useful for two different things. Okay, so Next Door was this very clever idea, social network again, but this one is based on your geographical neighborhood. And the way it works is that you can only become a part of the neighborhood sort of by being invited by somebody else in that neighborhood. So it was able to, at least that's the way it was when I joined. I don't know if it's changed. But in that way, you were able to only allow people into your neighborhood that truly live there. And our neighborhood, it's a nice unit. It's got a very defined edge.
You have one road into your neighborhood, and you've got a road association kind of definition. So it's pretty clear to see who lives there and who doesn't, kind of thing.
Yeah. So for years we tried to get online in a way that would help out, because some of us work a lot and don't get to see the signs that are down by the bridge of what the community events are. We have a nice little community area that we can all use. And so some of us were like, hey, we need to have a website. And we tried a website. It didn't work out. We tried email. It wasn't working out. But Nextdoor worked out really well. And they were just set up well to facilitate communication with our neighborhood and then the larger region as well. And they hooked into at least our local police force. The police can do announcements, and there's a little bit of back and forth.
Nice.
That way.
I guess I should use it. I haven't used it.
Well, and why don't you use it? Because you don't want to sit there and open an app every day to see what's going on. But
I also don't have I've got a much smaller community. I've got four household definition on the land that we're
on. So you wouldn't consider that entire road going up the mountain the one neighborhood?
Not,
you guys have a big event every year that I see the sign out for.
That's true. There's a couple events, and they've been going on for 115 years. It's crazy. And I know those people, but no, it's not really the same community. You can't walk our community, so you don't see people walking. It's driven the community.
Yeah. So, this worked well for our community.
Sure.
And something that I didn't notice, but a friend of mine did, is that my friend of mine lives in San Carlos area, sprawling Silicon Valley suburban neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And he noticed that you can post about crime and safety on Nextdoor. It's one of the great sort of uses for it. So if you saw someone suspicious walking around the neighborhood, kind of like a neighborhood watch program, you can say, hey, I see somebody really suspicious walking through the neighborhood. And what my friend noticed, and he stopped using Nextdoor for this reason, is you get posts like, there's a black man that looks really suspicious walking down our road.
Ah, racism.
Yes. So what was the suspicion for? The person didn't say. What is the person doing? They're just walking. What is the incriminating evidence? That they're black?
Right.
So
so your friend stopped using this because he started seeing something about his neighbors he didn't like.
Exactly. He didn't want to be seeing all of this unsubstantiated kind of talk and be influenced by it. And of course, we hear plenty of scary things on the news all the time. But the fact is, the crime statistics show that crime has been falling. So our perception is really important.
Yes.
Well, the creators of Nextdoor, there was an article that brought to light this whole issue, and it kind of spooked the creators of Nextdoor, and they did not want to have a hand in any sort of systemic racism. So, in fact, one of the creators is Indian and a person of color himself. So they set out to try to help this problem. It's not exactly a solvable problem because it's a very much a human problem, but sure. You can create a system that encourages the right things. So they were able, through a number of changes, to reduce the way that they measured it, 75% of the posts are no longer in any way racist or bigoted or can be pointed to as being discriminatory.
How, what kind of changes did they do? Did they help educate the users or did they just start filtering them?
Well, they did a number of things. But if they could find any keywords that were related to race, they would not let the post continue, and they would ask the person a few questions. They would make them kind of think through the problem a little bit more
nice.
By asking
Good.
These questions.
See, that sounds like educating somebody on the way they're thinking is the best way to do this. Like, filtering out does not really help, right? Because then the person that's saying these things and thinking these things feels like they're being muted, and therefore they might get angry about that.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It's
yeah,
much
absolutely.
Better to go – so do they have any examples?
Oh, absolutely. It says, ask yourself, is what you saw suspicious, especially if you take the race or ethnicity out of the equation? So this is all based on a Stanford psychologist's research named Jennifer Eberhardt. And she pointed out that if you try to make these decision points where people actually have to think about what they're saying, and so you're calling it education, it's really about thinking through the process so that you can try to take your natural biases and actually be confronted with them and look at them and be able to rephrase what you're saying. So through this process, they started losing engagement, which for a social network would normally scare them.
Right.
I mean, all of a sudden they're seeing a 50% drop off on posts about crime and safety. So half the people are being confronted with these questions and
right.
saying, okay, I'm not going to continue with this. But
So here's an example of a screen that shows up when you do write something that might be considered like a racial judgment. What details can add that will help distinguish the person from other similar people? And then it says, when race is indicated, you must include at least two of the highlighted fields. And this is hair, I don't know, top, like the shirt, bottom, shoes. So you actually had to add more information about the post when it looked like you were, when you're using race-based language as a descriptor. And of course, that allows you to think about it more. But of course, any time there's friction to any online system means you have less users. That's just the way it works. From a design perspective.
Exactly, yeah.
So, and also the 75% thing, or 75% thing, I wanted to clarify. They say that they reduce posts containing racial profiling by 75% in their test markets. So
exactly.
The post that – yeah, okay.
Thank you.
So
I didn't say that very well.
Sure, fine.
And it's kind of interesting how they judge that as well, but we might get to that later. So anyways, yeah, they're having this huge drop of engagement where people are not completing their posts. But I love the mindset behind this because they said we were completely okay with that because at the cost of less content, we're gaining much more constructive content.
Yes.
So
the value of the content is increasing.
Right, right. Right. So yeah, there's less posts.
You drop 75% of the posts that are all crappy and all of a sudden you have a lot better good posts. But the thing is, it's still true that the engagement is crucial. If you can't go on that app and participate, then you're not part of the system and you're going to stop using the app. So
they did not say that was happening. They were simply specifically talking about posts to crime and safety. I'm sure if people stopped using the app altogether and they saw a drop of usership across the board, they would be more concerned.
So I'm curious, like other things they could do. I mean, of course, what you in the neighborhood watch type of situation, you actually want to kind of get a feel for who is someone that's seen all the time and who is someone who's never seen? Because a person that's never seen is someone you want to pay more attention to, right?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming most of the time that's the case. So it seems to me there's features they could add to this app that would be extremely creepy and really useful. And I'm wondering if, for example, why not just take pictures of everybody you see outside your window? And then using facial recognition, you can see how often those people are seen across your neighborhood. And if it's someone that's, you know, you see once a week, but it's regular, you know, it's completely safe, right?
Well, yeah, except for I'll point out that our cell phones don't have zooms on them yet.
So it's kind of hard to get a facial read on somebody. You can do gait detection. The way a person walks.
Yeah.
I mean, this can get really creepy really quickly, I guess.
So let's remove the racism by creating a surveillance state.
That's what I'm saying. Basically, you could do that. I've wanted for a while to just get one of the, you know, police cars have license plate scanning systems, right?
Yes, keep track. We've talked about that in the past.
And I thought, well, God, I should just put one of those in my road, right? Just like from my house, just point it at the road and just know what license plates come along all the time. Why wouldn't you collect that kind of data? Everybody could do it. And of course, if I did that, I'd probably open source the whole project and then share it. And then, of course, you could produce a database over time.
Sharing the data?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things like we currently have an imbalance in our society where the people that know that information are the police force. Therefore, individuals don't know that. And therefore, you're in a situation where there's more power in the police force.
This is true.
Partially, that might be a concern, though I'm sure you could get some of that data from Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is true, but my fear is that somebody would hack into the police system and get all that data.
I know.
And you just want to publish it for the open web.
I'm not saying I'm doing this. I haven't done it, but it definitely is something I think about. I think it's great, and I think it's really cool that the company decided that the quote they have is the cost of less content. The cost of less content is the gain of more helpful and constructive content is wonderful, and hopefully they can keep that up.
Yeah, and I mean, this is very particular to this kind of social network, but honestly, I hope that is a lesson that more social networks can actually think about. I mean, I'm not using Facebook anymore. I'm not using Google Plus anymore. I'm moved off to other channels.
All right. Well, thank you for that story. And I do want to try this now, this app, just because I should. I normally try things out. And speaking of which, I do participate in the local town that I'm in. I participate in the Facebook page, or Facebook group. I think it's a page, which is invite only. And again, it's like that. You've got to invite people that invite people. Lots of people I know are actually in there because, of course, it's my neighborhood. And, you know, things like a firecracker goes off or a fire happens or somebody catches a skunk in their cage, that kind of debate happens. I almost never participate in it because it's so noisy. I mean, there's so many people talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, 6,000 people live in that area. I don't know how many people are on the Facebook page. But it is neat to see of my friends who is engaged in that conversation. So I run into somebody that I've seen being posting there, and I might chat with them about what they saw or posted about. Whatever happened to that raccoon? You know, I don't actually read the story, but I knew that they talked about it. So it's kind of a neat way to engage with your community.
Yeah, yeah. And those work because we talked about this before. Yeah, having somebody be able to moderate it is the key.
So I heard this story about Instagram and depression, and I want you to tell me a little bit more about it. I'm not sure if we covered it last week. Let me research that. But you go ahead and start the story.
I listened to last week's show. We I don't think we covered it.
Good.
No.
All right.
Okay. So Instagram. They have had some researchers.
Also owned by Facebook, by the way.
Yes. So what we got, WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook. But the important thing about Instagram is it is definitely still one of those social networks that's on the rise. And some researchers have decided to dive into the data, and they did a study with 43,950 participants. And what they were trying to do is determine whether you can see whether somebody is depressed through their posts on Instagram.
And of course, posts on Instagram include a photo.
Well, always. So that's the main thing about Instagram is posting photos and, of course, filters that you can put on the photos. Mm-hmm. So the kind of data that they were looking at was not just you know, what color the photo was, which is would be the stereotypical guess on how they're judging depression.
A desaturated photo means you're depressed.
Which does hold true to a degree. But they were also looking at other factors like how often a person posts and how often they engage with likes and whether there was human facial detection would check whether there was humans in the photo.
Okay.
And through these kind of signals, if there was less social engagement, therefore less people in the photos. If there was less posts going on, combined with the general cast of color of the photo and what filters you used, like they pinpointed the black and white filter, which is
that's a desaturated filter.
The desaturation filter. I just lost the name of it. Is definitely there's a huge spike in those that they identify that are depressed.
I hate to ask you this because, of course, it's going to be hard for you to recall this from the story completely. But how do you know that your bias is true? Like you say, if we think these things mean they're depressed, how do you confirm that? Because they didn't talk to therapists around these people, did they?
Well, they had multiple hypotheses. They were testing. And they did have to do human ratings on these people to be able to determine whether they are depressed or not.
So those human readings on those people were humans looking at their Instagram accounts?
No, these are humans doing interviews with the people in the
Thank
study.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
very
no, good. Okay. This is so a genuine study. That,
hey. Thank you. That's what I need to hear.
Yeah. No, they're using out-of-band data.
Thank you. Out-of-band data.
So the first hypothesis they were trying to figure out was whether you can distinguish reliably whether somebody is depressed by looking at these. The second one is whether you can do that by looking at the data before they are clinically diagnosed as depressed. In other words, up to the point where they're clinically diagnosed and the person knows that they're being diagnosed as depressed, can you just look at the data before that point and predict? There are ways that general practitioners, GPs, start to look at this.
Sure.
And they have both a guided and unguided way of doing it. They can use their own expertise, or they can also use these guided systems to determine depression. And this algorithm was able to be better than just the GP using their general knowledge and not using any of the guided systems to determine depression. So it actually was significantly helpful in that way.
Very cool.
The other hypothesis include whether they can distinguish posts made by whether the human ratings of Instagram posts on common semantic categories can distinguish between posts made by depressed and healthy individuals.
This was just inspecting linguist qualities of their posts?
Yes.
The language? Mm-hmm.
And
by the way, you know, the interviewing someone for depression and mental disorders is actually what – there's actually a manual, right? The DSM,
yes.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Very controversial on different things. It's changed over time. It's always being worked on. There's multiple versions of it. It started It's been around for a long time, maybe 1952. And basically, this is the textbook to figure out what disorders people have mentally.
Right, which of course have been redefined over the years.
Oh my gosh, over and over again. It's great.
Now, this is not something that can be used out of the box now. It's not like we're going to be analyzing everybody's Instagram just to determine depression anymore. But what this is it's saying there is a signal there that can be useful. And they're saying that we need to research this more and that there is a possibility of a useful tool out there.
I want to get access to this to analyze myself. I think it's fascinating.
Let's see if I can pull up these filters. Evernote is hurting me. No, I can't get that.
No, let's move on, because your next story, and actually the last one we're going to cover today, is one about Apple's personal assistant that shows up on your phone, and an interface for it. I/O, of course, in computer jargon, is what?
No. That's just the IOA domain.
I know, but it kind of means anyway. Tell us about. I guess we're just going
to
say it, right?
Okay, so there's a new website called HeySiri.io.
Hey-Siri.io.
Oh, there's a dash in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even see those anymore.
There's a
dash
now.
So a few shows ago, actually like a couple months ago, I got on this kick to try to use Siri more, to use all the different things I don't normally use so I can actually get proficient in them before the world passes me by. So I've been trying to scour the web for articles on what you can do with Siri and trying to explore my own things and find out stuff. Well, somebody went ahead and did it for me. They went ahead and made a site that is inclusive of everything we know that Siri can do. And
scripts and everything. It's
sample
very
scripts.
Cool.
It's really well organized. It's a beautiful site to peruse. And if you have any questions on what you can do with Siri, go take a look at it. I realized that I had exhausted most of the things it could do by the time I found this site. But you don't have to search the web for all the other articles. Just go here.
It's hey-siri.io. And it's all categorized under conversation, maths, date calculation, apps and app store, control and settings and HomeKit and notifications and contacts and calls. And every time you click one of these buttons, it kind of shows you samples of what you can do. You know, what's 9 plus 53 would be one of the mathematics ones. Let's see what...
All the different ways that you can ask about the weather or the humidity or the dew point.
How to FaceTime somebody. messaging in general. Earlier today, you were driving and you messaged me your location, so I knew how long it would be before you got here.
Yeah, I wanted you to be able to follow my entire trip from work to here.
And you use Siri for that, right?
Of course.
And all I got as a text message was share location, the phrase share location. So not exactly useful. So Siri is not always perfect, but in any case, this is very cool. And I agree that sometimes I want to know why what I'm saying is not working, and I get frustrated and give up. But it's funny to me that this is not natural language if you have to have a document that defines what you can say.
Well, okay.
It's user interface definition. It's an API. Like, it's you got to go there to train yourself how to talk to Siri.
Right. We know English, but we don't know Siri. We don't know the language of Siri.
Yeah,
It's funny. I mean, as a user interface programmer, you have to think about how discoverable your user interface is so that people will use the things that you put in there. But of course, Siri is entirely undiscoverable, at least if you don't want to just sit there and talk at it and see what happens.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, the one thing I do use Siri for is remind me of at a certain time or set a timer, which is great unless you're around other people. And then recently I wanted to add a reminder and I had to go and like open up the Reminders app. I don't even know how to use the Reminders app and like set up and set up. It was actually a lot harder to use the app to set myself a reminder in 15 minutes to do a certain thing than to talk to Siri. But I was in this environment where I didn't want to talk to people, you know.
Yeah.
Remind me to call my mother in an hour. It's not something I want to say in the bus in front of, sure, thousands of people on GeekSpeak, fine, but not on the bus at work. Hey,
it's funny. You want to know the most useful thing I've gotten out of using Siri that I didn't do before I started this little thing?
You know what? Hold on to that thought, and you can tell us right at the end of the show. We'll keep people involved. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 user stuff. Any way you'd like it, just let them know that Geek said hello. Thanks to our patrons, who I'll be thanking next week, first of the month. And also thanks to our intern, Chandler, who makes sure the website looks awesome. Thank you, Chandler. And also the show notes on the podcast of your choice. And also thanks to Greg Merkley, our support specialist in Canada, who provided this week's working title, Siri Calls a Cab for Next Door's Airline School. And thanks to Michael Newman of Pet Store Music for our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 36 of season 16. Okay, Brian, what's your most helpful Siri command lately?
Open settings for notifications, or open notification settings. So why? I can turn off all these notifications I still have on from all these apps I've installed from over the years.
That's awesome. You just want something to turn things off.
But do you know how long it takes to get there otherwise?
You're effectively... Yeah, that's it. So it's... What is it? Siri? Hey, Siri,
Hey, Siri, open notification settings.
You're telling your phone to have it not talk to you as much.
Exactly.
That's what you're doing. That's awesome. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for being on GeekSpeak.
It's a blast.
You have any follow-up? Anything to close out with?
Oh, I don't know. Skype is going away?
That's not good. No, it's not going away.
No, it's not going away. But it's a scary title. Microsoft has end-of-lifed the native Mac and Linux and old Windows apps. They're still going to be working for a while. We don't know.
What are they switching over to?
They're switching over to an entirely web-based WebRTC system.
That's very cool.
It's cool, but it's the funny thing is Skype was big for so long based on being a peer-to-peer video audio call system.
Right.
Things have evolved. Skype was known for being one of the best call qualities you could possibly get, and people even use it for podcasting and video podcasting.
Sure.
So that you could have a remote person.
But none of that goes away. I mean, RTC... RTC, by the way, stands for real-time communication. It's part of an API. The Web RTC is part of the World Wide Web's consortium, W3C, which I sat on for a while, which is kind of cool. API that defines real-time communications, and it allows for open ports to communicate and how you control that data flow through JavaScript. It's really cool. And people have been making kind of proto apps for, I don't know, 5 years that do video and audio feeds, and there's really good ones. And if you're using a concurrent browser, no problem with speed and quality and all that stuff.
And that's just the thing. We constantly have this march of some proprietary solution that then becomes standardized and published in maybe a different technology, but it replaces the same problem.
Right.
And WebRTC seems to be ready. In fact, Google's Hello app is using WebRTC, I believe.
And so is Google Hangouts, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There you go.
So we use Google Hangouts to kind of record the back channel of what we do live and share it with our intern, our Geek supporter, and our patrons we invite on also as well. If you're curious about supporting GeekSpeak, please feel free to visit geekspeak.org/support. And also, if you're not subscribed to GeekSpeak via podcast, please do so. It definitely helps spread the love. Well, thanks, Brian. That was fun.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Am I cutting you off? Do you have something else to say about it?
Oh, only if anybody wants to hear me lament about an old computer company that I really...
What company's going away?
Silicon Graphics.
Really?
SGI.
No, why?
Well, they've gone away several times. That's the funny thing. So they went bankrupt back in 2006. They were once the preeminent graphics machine that you could possibly get.
Everything from
2002 and before, every computer graphics movie and commercial you saw leading up to that point was done on SGI or maybe in the early days of Cray.
Mm-hmm.
They hit some hard times as PCs became fast enough.
Yeah.
And
did you see that movement in the industry? And for those that don't know, Brian's history is in computer graphics. He has worked on the Monsters, Inc. He was a lighting designer for Monsters, Inc. So if you've seen that film, you've seen his work. So you know a lot about 3D rendering and the commercial industry and movie production and such. Did you ever work on SGI machines or did you come
my entire 4 years of school is on SGIs. I was sneaking the labs constantly to use those things. When I started in my career in 95, it was $40,000 to get a basic workstation that you could use, which was an SGI. And then the software is another $20,000 or $40,000, depending on what you're using.
Wow.
And then, let's see, that was in 95. By, what was it, 2000 and... Definitely 2002, but I think before we were on PCs.
What shop were you working on at that point?
The switchover happened while I was at Pixar.
Okay.
So when I started there, they were all SGI machines, one of which went up in a cloud of smoke. And truly. And then by the time I left, we were on PCs and talking about moving to G5 Max.
When you say PCs, you mean Windows machines?
Total Linux Windows machines. Total Linux machines.
Linux machines.
Just regular... Not regular, but I mean, it was good hardware, but it was not custom Silicon Graphics pipelines running through MIPS processor or anything like that. It was a straight up x86 machine.
What kind of graphics machine? What kind of graphics card?
You know, I wasn't able to track that. You know, those things change every 3 months, so there's no way to keep on top of it.
I was wondering if it was NVIDIA or AMD.
Pretty sure it was NVIDIA. Okay. At that time, NVIDIA was king. In fact, a lot of the engineers in NVIDIA, I believe, came from SGI.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that's why their graphics pipeline had such a boost.
That's really cool.
Anyways, they've been the remnants of them were sold to another company in 2009 from another bankruptcy, and... That company, which took on SGI's name, is being bought by HP because they have a technology that's particularly good in the big supercomputer space, and HP's going to try to compete in that space.
SGI kind of went away, was purchased, and then went bankrupt, and then, of course, the assets were sold, and the SGI name went along to somebody else, and now that name's being sold again. So it's not really like it's dying. It's just kind of moving around again.
It's moving around again. It died a long time ago, but it came up in the news, and it brought up memories.
Definitely. All right. Well, thanks, Brian.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
All right.